abandon free market principles to save the free market system.
In a world of conventional confusion,
There will be time for them to make profits. Now's not that time.
Daddy, what do taxes pay for?
Oh, why everything. Policemen, trees, sunshine. And let's not forget the folks who just don't feel like working, God bless them.
Don't be afraid of your freedom.
Prepare to unshackle your mind.
An idea whose time has come cannot be stopped by any army or any government.
Your professor has arrived. Tom Woods. Beware, citizen. You are now departing from the world of allowable opinion. The Tom Woods Show.
Welcome, everybody. It is Friday, November 29th, 2013. A couple quick notes before we get to our guest today. The first is I've been getting a lot of requests from people to write up something or make some comment about the recent document by Pope Francis on economics, on capitalism. And I will do that. I'm not going to have time to write anything. As you all know, I'm working very, very hard on the Ron Paul homeschool curriculum, and that's many, 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 many hundreds of videos that I need to research and record. So that's an awful lot of time to invest in a project, but I think it's probably the most important project I've ever worked on. I'm really happy with the way the courses that I'm preparing for these kids are coming out. But it really is cutting into my writing time. By 2015, I'll be writing a lot more once again. But for now, what I'll do is next week, I'll devote a program just to this. It'll be just me talking, and I'll come on here and I'll analyze that document, which I haven't had time to read yet, but I'm sure it's the same old stuff. It sounds to me like Pope Paul VI all over again. I don't mean that as a compliment. In the meantime, on my website, tomwoods.com, I have an articles page, and in that articles page, you will find a section on Catholic social teaching. And if you read those articles, that's pretty similar to what I'll probably say on the program, although I'll have specific comments about the current document. So you can check that out. And then also my book, The Church and the Market, which I think is actually one of the best things I've ever done. It really is just an introduction to Austrian economics. If you've read Economics in One Lesson, but you feel like you're not ready to read Human Action, you could read The Church and the Market, whether you're religious or not, whether you're a Catholic or not. It really is just an introduction to Austrian economics, but it's more intermediate, I suppose, than just a plain old introduction, but it really covers everything. I mean, from praxeology, from the beginnings of economics in terms of starting off with the action axiom and reasoning your way all the way to more advanced propositions, but everything from prices and wages and monopoly theory and money and banking and the Fed and all kinds of topics that you would expect to be covered are covered in my book, The Church and the Market. You can read about that on the books page at tomwoods.com. So we'll get to that next week. Now for my Black Friday announcement. It's Black Friday, and what fun would it be if I didn't participate in this? Well, you all know I have this website, libertyclassroom.com, and if you haven't heard about it, I just want you to give me 60 seconds to give you my pitch, all right? That's all I ask. You have this free show. I just want 60 seconds of your time. LibertyClassroom.com is a place where, just like when you go to this company, The Great Courses, you can buy courses on different topics that are taught by professors at great universities. Well, my courses are taught by people you know you can trust, and you don't buy one course at a time. When you subscribe, you get every single course we have, and you can listen to them anytime you want. You can watch them in video, or you can listen to them on your iPod, or listen to them on any device you want, and they are going to teach you the real history you wish you'd been taught in school, the real economics you wish you'd been taught in school, the real history of philosophy you wish you'd been taught in school. We've got 8 courses right now. We got a 9th course coming in just a couple of weeks, and you can learn from me and from people that I trust at your own pace. We got recommended readings for each talk. We've got Q&A forums where you can get any question about this material answered anytime you want to for a full year. Plus, we do a live question and answer session for members only once a month. But this is the best thing I've ever done. And if you've got somebody in your family, a student who needs a lifeline to professors he can trust, a gift subscription to Liberty Classroom is just what the doctor ordered. If you know somebody who's interested in liberty ideas, who isn't a student, who just is a lifelong learner, then a gift subscription to LibertyClassroom.com is just what the doctor ordered. So head over to LibertyClassroom.com. You'll see a gift subscription icon right at the top. You click on that, and you can get 35% off as a Black Friday offer. 35% off at libertyclassroom.com for your loved ones. And then also for yourself, don't click on the gift subscription. You're going to buy it for yourself. Just go ahead and get yourself a subscription. You can also get 35% off for yourself. For yourself, you'll need a coupon code, though. No coupon code necessary for gift subscriptions. But for yourself, you will need coupon code CLASS, C-L-A-S-S, in all caps. Coupon code CLASS gets you 35% off at libertyclassroom.com. Do this before you forget, because you'll be sad if you miss this offer. This is the best deal in the world. You're never going to see this many courses offered so cheaply. And as I say, throughout the year, I always add at least three courses a year. So you're getting an enormous amount for a trivial amount of money. You're getting way more than you could possibly expect. It's like getting a Cadillac for 10 bucks. So libertyclassroom.com, click on the gift subscription icon, get 35% off. Or if you want to buy it for yourself, just go ahead and do that and use coupon code CLASS. Okay, let's turn now to Phil Giraldi. Philip Giraldi is a former counterterrorism specialist and military intelligence officer of the CIA. He spent almost 20 years overseas in Europe and the Middle East working on terrorism cases. He spent time in Turkey, Italy, Germany, and Spain, and he's fluent in Turkish, Italian, German, and Spanish, as you would expect, being stationed in those countries. He has appeared on Good Morning America, 60 Minutes, MSNBC, Fox News Channel, National Public Radio, the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation, the British Broadcasting Corporation, Al Jazeera, and others. So I'm very glad to welcome to the program right now Phil Giraldi. Thanks for being here, Phil.
Thank you for having me on.
I'd been wanting to have you on for some time, and then I saw this piece that you wrote for the American Conservative where you write regularly, and it had to do with an issue that has sort of fallen out of the news cycle, but really there's no Middle Eastern country that's permanently out of the news cycle when you're an American. And you had a particularly interesting angle on it because it turns out that the evidence with regard to chemical weapons being used by the Syrian government was so flimsy even by U.S. government standards that apparently there was a threatened revolt within the intelligence community. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, well, it goes back, of course, to Iraq. And we all know now that the intelligence community was, to a certain extent, blamed for what went wrong in the lead-up to the Iraq War. In other words, the information and the intelligence that was received by the government that turned out to be either fabricated or incorrect was basically laid at the feet of the intelligence community. So this time around, when the Obama administration was looking for an intelligence justification to intervene in Syria, the intelligence community, or at least certain elements in it, looked at the evidence and basically said, this doesn't convince me that Syria used chemical weapons against its own people, and we won't go on record as saying that that was the case.
So do you think, what kind of effect do you think this had? I mean, do you think this would have bothered the Obama people? Do you think this had a marginal effect on their ultimate decision?
Well, the Obama people went back and as in the case of the Bush people, tried to pressure the analysts into finding more information or interpreting it in a different way to make the case. But there was still a considerable resistance, which eventually worked out to when the administration issued its own paper called the Government Assessment on August 30th. It came out of the White House instead of out of the intelligence community, because the threat that was implicit was that a number of senior analysts would have resigned and gone public with their disagreement with the paper. In the long run, of course, we didn't attack Syria, and you can attribute it, I think, in part to this, but also, I think, more so to the fact that the American people finally had had enough, and Congress and the White House were flooded with complaints from citizens saying, basically, we don't need another war. There's no justification for the U.S. getting involved in Syria.
Now, you and I tend to be of the opinion that the two parties, especially when it comes to foreign policy, can often be more alike than different. But I wonder, though, when we're dealing with Obama, if maybe for all his use of drones and for the fact that he has increased the American role in Afghanistan and all that, all the same, is it possible that he genuinely just, his heart is genuinely not in another war?
Yeah, I've suspected that for a long time, that he's being driven in certain policies by advisors and by consensus politics and by the fact that, you know, he can't be seen in certain ways by his own supporters as well as by the Republicans. So I think he's in a very tough neighborhood, and I suspect his heart is not in this stuff. I suspect in the current situation he doesn't want a war with Iran. Would like a negotiated solution if he can get that by the Israel lobby. And certainly, I think in Syria, he was pushed into it perhaps by some of his advisors like Samantha Powers and Rice, essentially on humanitarian grounds. But as we've seen, the humanitarian argument was pretty weak. The use of military force to kill more Syrians obviously would not have ameliorated the state of other Syrians. So it was a false premise to start with.
Now, I ask this not facetiously, but where do you think we would be right now, foreign policy-wise, if we were living under not a President Romney, who may, it seems at least conceivable, he might have had some kind of prudence, but where would we be under a President McCain, do you think?
Well, I think there would have been no hesitation for using military force either with McCain or Romney. McCain would have probably been more enthusiastic about it. But again, you know, it's a question of one, how one views the world and how one views America's role in the world. And there is something to say for the United States having some kind of policeman's role. But there is not much of a case really to be made for America being an aggressor in terms of trying to enforce its own norms on other countries. So there's a fine line there. And I think Obama kind of falls on one side of the line, and I think people like McCain and Romney fall on the other side.
Now, when I introduced you, of course, I mentioned your CIA background, so I don't know how comfortable you feel talking about this, but do you think that the CIA has in one way or another gotten maybe worse in the, maybe, I don't know, is it 20 or so years? When did you resign or retire from the CIA?
I left the CIA in 2002, so that's 11 years ago.
Okay, I mean, do you think that, of course, we were talking about this case of Syria where there was a threatened mass resignation, but do you think there have also just been quiet resignations here and there without a lot of fanfare from conscientious people who just say, you know, I just can't do what they're inevitably going to be asking me to do?
Yeah, I think that always takes place. Basically, there are going to be people that basically say that I can't support these policies, I can't support what's happening, and most of them just quietly leave. There were a number of notable resignations at senior levels in the lead up to Iraq, but there hasn't been a replay of the Iraq situation since that time, although Syria threatened to be that, and certainly if we keep going down the wrong road with Iran, that could certainly happen there, too. But, yeah, I think people do. There's sort of if one goes to some of the anti-war type sites that you and I probably look at, you would see that there are people that basically think that soldiers are baby killers and that people who work for the national security state are essentially conscienceless. They leave their conscience at the door where they go in. But, of course, that's not true. And many people are conflicted about their roles in working in these jobs. And I can remember many, many acrimonious debates when I was in CIA about certain policies that didn't make sense or that seemed to be particularly tone deaf in terms of the impact on local people.
Well, how much can you tell us about the type of counterterrorism work that you did? Was it confined to a particular area of the world? Was it Islamic terrorism? What sort of work kept you occupied when you were in the CIA?
Well, everybody forgets, I think, these days that terrorism that started out in the 70s was European. And it was basically a number of groups like Baader-Meinhof in Germany, the Red Brigades in Italy. These were European anarchists, leftists primarily, people who came together and formed terrorist groups to with the goal of overthrowing their governments. So I started out working with those groups. I went to Italy when Aldo Moro was kidnapped and killed. Spent 4 years there. Worked in Germany, worked in Spain, worked in Turkey. And I was always working on terrorist groups, most of which were either indigenous or European. The turn to more terrorism coming out of the Islamic world was kind of later, and it's a manifestation, I think, now of various things. But I think a lot of the policies that the U.S. and other countries have pursued internationally have really put fuel on the fire in terms of creating this kind of terrorism.
Now, I myself, I don't reject every single thing that I read in the New York Times, for example. I mean, they do use periods and semicolons correctly. I mean, not every single thing that comes out of their mouths is wrong. But is there any part of you that finds the bin Laden story a little bit fishy, or does that seem plausible? We got him. We don't have any direct evidence of this. We immediately got rid of him, threw him in the water, and there's no body and there's no nothing, but take our word for it, this happened. Does that not just sound a little bit weird to you?
Yeah, it does. I mean, I don't generally want to believe in conspiracy theories and that sort of thing, but you look at a lot of these recent episodes, and you have to say there's something missing from this story. Like, for example, if you go to the 9/11 report, there's certain areas in there you say, well, why didn't they look at this, or why didn't they discuss that? Which is not to say that the United States blew up these buildings itself. But the fact is, there are certain things they didn't look at. And I feel the same way about the killing of bin Laden. And certainly Seymour Hersh, who as a journalist I respect tremendously, has been saying recently that a lot of the story is just flat out false.
And yet, I guess maybe this is naivete on my part, but I guess I just found it hard to imagine that Obama could go out there and just brazenly say to the world, we just did this, we went out and did this, when conceivably, if there's something fishy about the story, there'd be a lot of people and a lot of regimes around the world that would know the truth. But would the idea be that no one's going to believe them anyway? They'll believe the U.S. and they won't believe some backward Middle Eastern country.
Well, I think that's the kind of weighing up that goes on. Obviously, when a head of state decides to tell part of a story, he's assuming that he's not going to be challenged on it, and that he can always claim that the critics are motivated by for other reasons, for political reasons. And I think that's what a lot of the consensus of American policy, even since the Second World War, has been cast that way, where we've been fed a lot of lies or half-truths, and the people peddling these stories basically have assumed that they won't be challenged.
Now, you played some kind of role with Ron Paul in some kind of advisory capacity. Is that in both of his presidential campaigns?
I was a foreign policy advisor for Ron Paul in his first campaign in 2008, yes.
Now, what were you approached to do that, or did you approach them with your services?
I was approached to do that by his campaign.
And why did you accept? I mean, I presumably you saw some overlap between what he was saying and what you believed?
Well, I felt very strongly that he was saying precisely what I thought, which is essentially I'm not a pacifist. I'm not intrinsically anti-war. I served in the U.S. Army during Vietnam, just as Ron Paul served in the Air Force. And Paul was saying essentially the same things I'm saying, that there are wars that are worth fighting, but we just haven't had any lately. And we shouldn't be using the military as a tool to go off and start wars as a substitute for foreign policy. And that's essentially Ron Paul's message, that intervention doesn't work. That if you're using it instead of diplomacy, you're essentially going to come out with a bad result. And I think that what he's been saying about that has been demonstrated by the reality that we see all around us.
I suppose you know Michael Scheuer. Did you have any professional connection when you were with the CIA?
No, I didn't, because he was an analyst and I was a field operative in the clandestine services. So I heard his name, I knew who he was, and I've met him since then. And we've been together on a number of shows. We were on CNN not so long ago together. He's a very, very insightful person in terms of a lot of the things that he's seen in terms of the causes of terrorism, which goes back to your earlier question about, you know, where this all kind of originated and how it came out.
Well, to my mind, I mean, and of course, he also worked with Ron Paul, but to my mind, the most significant contribution Dr. Paul made to American life was his frank talk about foreign policy. I mean, he talked frankly about everything you asked him about, but foreign policy, he was saying things that nobody would say, that there might be a few progressives out there who in their heart of hearts kind of believe it, but in political life, they wouldn't dare say it. And now he's there's a lot of toothpaste that's out of the tube. But do you think there's anybody on the horizon at a national level who's really going to carry forward the pure 100-octane Ron Paul message?
I'm afraid not, but these situations are change in terms of what the reality of our foreign policy and what's going on in the world is like. Ron Paul has created an opening for this kind of discussion to take place, because it never, as you pointed out, it never took place before that. He was the first one to open that door. But I don't see anyone having either the courage or the intellectual stature that Ron Paul had to push forward this agenda. I'm afraid of that we don't have politicians who believe, as Ron Paul believes, that our international policy, our foreign policy, is what has driven a lot of the bad things going on domestically. And I think Ron Paul understood that very clearly, and other politicians don't seem to. They weigh up this against that, and they figure out, well, I have to say this, or I have to do that. And when they do that, of course, they lose the message.
How do you account for how it came about that all these right-wingers out there who, by and large, have been supporting whatever military action either party has demanded of them, all of a sudden, almost entirely rebelled against the John McCain wing and said, we don't want to be involved in Syria, and we protest, and the Iowa GOP issued this public letter with dozens and dozens of people signing it, many of them from the Christian right, and all of a sudden, for the first time ever, they're suddenly deeply concerned about the fate of Christians in the Middle East, which has not caused them to lose much sleep up to that point. What do you think changed? What happened there?
Well, again, I think Ron Paul started this discussion, and people started looking at these issues as a result of his two campaigns. And the problem is a lot of it is a bit hypocritical. You have been looking at Christians now, but they haven't looked at the fate of Christians in places like Israel and Iraq, where Christians have been on the receiving end of a lot of bad policy. So, it's a current issue. Syria just somehow, hit the right buttons with the public. But again, it would not have happened without Ron Paul opening the door to this kind of discussion. And I hope it persists, but I'm not optimistic. I think that essentially all politics, even if they originate overseas, come down to being local politics, and our domestic situation is just so bad now. The economy is so bad, and Obamacare clearly is going to be a massive failure and money pit. And as a result, I think people will begin to focus on that more.
Well, in a way, that's good for us, because it'd be harder to persuade them that their most urgent task is abroad, when everybody can clearly see our most urgent tasks are here at home. So that may be the silver lining to the fact that the wheels are coming off this thing. Now, you, as a former CIA field man, how do you get your information today? You want to know what's really going on in the world. You don't pick up the Washington Post. What do you read?
Well, it's first of all, I have like a network of former intelligence and military officers that I communicate with frequently. So we share views, we share things that we've picked up and seen, and sometimes these people have seen things that are not evident in the U.S. media. And I also find that the overseas media is very helpful to look at what people in the Middle East are saying, what people in Europe are saying, and that sort of thing. And then the final thing is, I guess, you know, like this story here, it was basically I picked up a number of things here and there and put them together. And I said, well, what makes sense out of these bits and pieces? And essentially I put it together and I said, yeah, this is what happened. And some of the process is intuitive. Some of the process is essentially you hear something from someone who is well-informed and you kind of run with it.
Well, before I let you go, I want to play devil's advocate on just one aspect of the sort of Ron Paul story of what's going on in terms of terrorism and war. And that's the neocon answer that, look, if Ron Paul's view of the world were correct, then all the terrorism would be committed against the U.S. and its most robust allies. But the fact is, we see acts of Islamic terrorism going on in the Netherlands, for example, or in other European countries that don't really seem 1,000% on board with the global war on terror. So it really is just as we neocons said. These are jihadists. They want to bring about the caliphate. They don't really care. They don't discriminate between the U.S. and others. We're all Western infidels, and that's what matters, and there's no appeasing these people, so we just need to obliterate every last one of them.
Well, that argument has a certain popularity among the neocons.
You don't say.
it doesn't really pass the smell test because a lot of the issues that we call terrorism are actually local issues. If you look at many of the countries in the Middle East where there is what we would describe as jihadism, the fact is that what motivates the groups locally are local issues. And they have a grievance with their government, or they have a grievance with their group. Now, in Europe, the terrorism situation is a lot more complicated. Essentially, you have a number of European countries which permitted large-scale Muslim immigration and then basically essentially abandoned these people to ghettos. And you know, we Americans should understand that. The problem of creating ghettos in terms of your own country is a problem that will breed all kinds of things. And I think that the terrorism we see in France is rooted in that. Netherlands, to a certain extent, the same sort of thing in Germany. And these are all, you know, it's easy to characterize them as Islamic terrorism, but of course they're a lot more complicated than that. They come out of different issues in each place. In France, of course, the terrorists, we mostly Algerian. In the Netherlands, they're mostly Moroccans. In Germany, they were mostly Turks. And each of them have different grievances with the places where they've wound up. So I think you have to look at the roots for the terrorism in each place, and you find that it is no transnational movement in most cases.
Where can people read columns by Phil Giraldi?
Well, I write regularly for the American Conservative. I write for both the magazine edition and for the website. I write for Anti-War regularly, every week. Those are my two regular, most frequently used websites.
All right, I'll make sure and direct people over there. Well, Phil Giraldi, I really appreciate your time today and your insight that I genuinely can't get anywhere else. So thanks so much for your time.
Okay, thank you.
And that's it for the program for today. I hope you enjoyed my chat with Phil Giraldi. Don't forget, 35% off at libertyclassroom.com as a Black Friday offer. Maybe it'll go to Cyber Monday if I'm in a good mood, but who knows? You might as well do it now before you miss this opportunity forever. So head over to libertyclassroom.com, click on that gift subscription icon, or if you just want to buy one for yourself, just go ahead and buy one and use coupon code CLASS in all caps. And remember, you can help us keep the lights on here in my little Tom Woods show office by entering Amazon through our little Amazon widget at tomwoodsradio.com. Lots of great programming next week, everybody. We'll see you then.
The Tom Woods Show.